Hi, I'm Steve Goldstein, and this is the Friday Newscap podcast. Each week, we review the biggest stories with experts, reporters, and commentators to put the news in perspective. Here's this week's episode.
What I've learned from the governor is that he's looking for the right answers to these complex problems. I think he expects me to tell him the truth as I see it scientifically, and then I understand that he gets to make the decision, not just from my input, but a whole host of inputs on any given issue. So I will always be honest with him and give him my best thoughts on any particular issue that I have responsibility for.
So first, I want everyone to get the vaccine who can get the vaccine. That's our tool. That's our solution. That's our way out of it. We've got personal vigilance, and we've got the vaccine. I want people to get the vaccine.
We have been given ample warning in other nations on other sides of the globe that indicate that this mutated Delta variant of this virus does infect children, moves rapidly from child to child or child to adult.
I assume communications between Senator Fan and her peers, or Senator Fan and the vendor, just without seeing a particular document in front of me, it seems like those would be subject to a claim of legislative privilege.
And with us to talk about the latest with the so-called ballot audit, vaccinations and masking and more, are Jaime Molera of Molera Alvarez. Jaime, welcome back.
Good to talk to you again.
And attorney and former congressional staffer Roy Herrera. Roy, good morning to you.
Good morning. Happy Friday.
Same to you, and happy long weekend for some people coming up as well. Jaime, let's start off with what we learned a little bit about this week as far as the cyber ninjas and the so-called audit is concerned. There are some things that are really troubling to people with these thousands of pages that have been released. Perhaps even more troubling, though, thousands of texts and emails that are not going to be released. What do you make of this whole thing at this point?
Well, it's almost like a poker player that's trying to take a three and an eight and make it into aces. they're just continuing to play a bad hand, and I think they're afraid of the embarrassment that's going to happen if a lot of these texts and emails get out. And certainly they're citing legislative privilege, and they don't want the media to take a look at that. But the thing that a lot of us have been saying for months now, almost a year, we just need to move on from this. I mean, there are other things that the legislature could be doing, the Republicans, the majority in the legislature could be doing. You know, they just got an early Christmas gift on this Supreme Court ruling for 208, reversing that. So there are things like that that they could be delving into as opposed to continuing to push this that's really not going to pay any kind of political dividends. As a matter of fact, it'll be contrary to dividend. It'll really hurt them if they continue to push this issue.
For week to week, Mark and I discuss what topics we're going to bring up, and we never want to keep bringing this one up, but guess what? We did again. So based on the information that has been released so far, talk about that for a bit. And then let me ask you the question that we obviously heard in the news cut and that Jaime just referenced. Legislative privilege, how can it really apply here when it comes to this, considering Cyber Ninja's relationship? What do you make of that particular part of this argument?
Well, as to the first part, I mean, I agree with Jaime. I'd much rather be talking about other things. And, it seems like we've been talking about this audit for so long, and I just don't know when it will end. And we are seeing some information come out. We now have some text messages that suggest that people associated with the audit had concerns about security lapses at the Coliseum. That's not surprising. I mean, I think we always had concerns. Certainly the Department of Justice had concerns at one point when they sent the letter. We also learned that, Trump and or at least people associated with Trump may have been interested in funding the audit. Again, that's not particularly surprising, given that, in my view, this audit has always been about helping Trump and his supporters introduce some doubt into the outcome of the election last year, in which he lost. So the information that we have learned, I think, just again demonstrates the unprofessional and political nature of the audit. I don't understand, why Republicans, or some Republicans, I should say, want this to continue, because it makes no sense. It's baseless. It's groundless. And also, I think will hurt, to Jaime's point, hurt them politically if it keeps going in next November's election. So that's, that's interesting developments that we've seen this week, but of course disturbing because it reconfirms a lot of the fears that I've had about the audit. Really quickly about legislative privilege, I don't want to get into sort of the scope of it, because I do think that these cases are going to be instructive as how, privilege is, legislative privilege in particular, is interpreted by the courts going forward. And I've got other matters that I have to worry about related to that. But I will say, the fact that there has been this long drawn out fight over some of these public records does suggest that perhaps the people that are holding these records may not want these records to be released. I don't know that. I mean, that's sort of what we're guessing here.
Jaime, based on some of what we saw in the release documents, you know, Senate President Karen Fann has said all along, has really stressed that this is not about overturning the election. It's not about Donald Trump. It's about looking forward and trying to strengthen election laws in some Republicans' eyes. Is her, how, I guess the question isn't, is her argument hurt by the release of the documents? Because clearly, as both you and Roy pointed out, this is in large part about Donald Trump. I guess maybe the question is, how much is that argument that this is not about Trump hurt based on what we saw this week?
Well, a lot of what might be in those texts and emails could be about members of her caucus that for her would be politically troublesome if they didn't continue to pursue this effort. Because let's be honest, there's quite a few members that would do whatever they can to continue this and give it more fuel. They would throw more gasoline on this fire if they could. So she has to balance that. And I think if that came out, I think it would show that this is more about the internal politics as opposed to dealing with election law issues. I mean, we had a bunch of election law issues that were passed this session, and there's probably going to be more coming down the pike next session. I'm just surprised that they're not focused on issues like, for instance, I've mentioned 208 and the Supreme Court reversing that, but also initiative reform. There's a lot of things that they can be doing that would fit within their the scope of what the Republicans stand for, as opposed to continuing to push this issue. Like I said, it's just a bad hand, and they continue to double down on something that I just think politically was going to hurt them next November if they keep pushing this.
Jaime, do you think based on what we've seen so far, there have been some text messages, some comments from Karen Fann about some of her caucus members to other folks. Does that potentially hurt her? We saw some comments she made about Kelly Townsend, about Paul Boyer. Does that hurt her?
Well, it could be embarrassing, and it could cause a rift within the caucus. And I just think that, there already is a rift within that caucus. I think everybody knows it. But this would exacerbate it if a lot of those came to light.
Roy, let me ask you the same question I asked Jaime initially, which is about Karen Fann's argument that this is not about President Trump. It would seem as though, based on some of what we saw this week, that's not necessarily everybody's belief here.
That's right. I mean, some of the communications, as I sort of referenced before, indicate, at least from Jeff DeWitt, that Trump may have been interested in funding this thing. And so, again, it's not surprising. And it makes total logical sense. I mean, we, again, and I've said this on the show before, have really good election administration in this state. We run really good elections here, and that's because in a bipartisan manner, historically we've come together to do that. And so the idea that there was fraud or misconduct or anything sort of wrong that would suggest that the election results in November were inaccurate in some way, that's all just false, and it's been false from the very beginning. And we've even had audits done by election officials already that showed that everything was accurate. So one would only sort of logically conclude that the reason this is going forward is because, folks that support Trump and didn't want to see him lose are trying to call into question, based on his instructions, by the way, because, he has said these kinds of things nationally, to try to call into question those particular results. But again, it doesn't make any sense, and I think the other piece to this, of course, is we've been waiting for this report that the cyber ninjas are supposed to release, and that's been delayed. I'm not sure there's really even a sort of release date for it at this point. And again, that calls into question whether they're kind of searching for a narrative here that's not based on reality, and they're having trouble, finding that narrative.
I mean, that comes back to your poker analogy, which is, are they trying to find something? I mean, again, many people would say they've been trying to find something that isn't there for months and months and months. Are they trying to even say, because they know people are covering this and everyone's talking about it, delaying it a couple weeks isn't going to make a difference. They're still going to get attention for whatever they decide.
I think a lot of those folks that are involved in this are looking at what is the end game. And I think how do they extricate themselves in a way that is not completely embarrassing, as well as how do they placate their own base? There's a lot of folks in their base that would be very upset, one, if nothing didn't happen. Two, they would criticize the leaders of this for not doing it properly. They will say, well, you really didn't fund it. You didn't give them the information. You didn't press hard enough from the county to get all the technology and materials that you needed in order to get to the proof of the smoking gun. So that's where I think they're trying to figure out how do they put something out that satisfies their own constituents and also that doesn't totally embarrass themselves with the media.
Roy, big picture, how difficult is this dynamic for Democrats, frankly, who may benefit from this politically, but many Democrats have also been concerned about how this affects democracy?
Yeah, that's totally right. I mean, I have this same sort of struggle myself. I mean, in the short term, and when I say short term, I'm talking through next November, I think it is likely that if this audit continues, that will benefit Democrats, because we have seen that beyond a portion of the Republican base, you know, Arizonans, you know, don't like the audit, don't believe that it should be taking place. And so it could help, you know, the Democratic gubernatorial candidate, or it could help, you know, Democrats across the state. But I have, you know, deep concerns, and I say this as a citizen and also as an election lawyer, about whether this kind of precedent going forward, having these kinds of audits, having these kinds of questions raised about the outcome of elections, questions that are really not based on anything. They're you know, the allegations associated with any kind of fraud are baseless. I really have concerns about that, because I feel like it'll erode our confidence in elections. And at the end of the day, that's the bedrock of everything that we do as a democracy in our government. We have to believe our elections are true and accurate. And then we can have the debates about, you know, the other issues, the important issues, like Jaime points out, like, you know, like taxes and other things. And so I wish we were in that world, because this world, when we're talking about elections and fraud, is a really dangerous one.
Jaime, let me ask you about something you just said, which is that your thought that the auditors are trying to find a space between placating their base, making them happy, and not embarrassing themselves. Does such a space actually exist?
Well, I don't think so, but they're certainly taking the time to try and find it. I think if they had found a way out of this, you know, we would have probably seen a report about a month ago. But we continue to have delays, because I just think that there's disagreement as to how they're going to move this forward. You know, right now, Republicans have an opportunity nationally. Of course, we see the trends that are happening. They could have a very good year. To Roy's point, I mean, if the Republicans continue to push this issue, it takes away attention from other things that they could be very much aggressive on, and they could have an upper hand with the Democrats come next year. But this is just eating away at that. And all the attention, look how much time we've been spending on this issue. They are not focusing on areas that really could be helpful in winning elections, as opposed to trying to save face on an issue that really, it's just, there's nothing there.
That's, we'll probably see those independent voters have an even bigger impact next year than they already have because
Correct.
Of that kind of issue. Yeah. Our guests today, attorney and former congressional staffer Roy Herrera and Jaime Molera of Molera Alvarez. Well, let me ask you, let's move to COVID now, another of our favorite topics from week to week on this program, which also never seems to stop. Governor Ducey has authorized $60 million to support staffing at healthcare facilities, but those in particular that use particular techniques. And there's been concern about the governor in some ways related to COVID putting conditions on various things. $60 million, yes, sounds great, but what do you make of the fact that he's put conditions on the money?
Well, you know, it's the mix of talking about COVID and baseless claims of election fraud, I think, is sort of a microcosm of what is going wrong in Arizona right now. So it's a difficult one. You know, as far as, you know, this particular grant or, you know, this particular funding source, I mean, as far as I understand it, the hospitals themselves are not sort of protesting on these restrictions, although I'll note that, you know, the funding is dependent on hospitals utilizing a particular treatment that actually can't be used on children. So to the extent that, you know, we're dealing with this increase in child infection, I'm not sure that would help. But it does get to a sort of a larger thematic point, which is that the governor has put, you know, restrictions on funding related to COVID in other arenas, and most notoriously related to, you know, federal funding to school districts, and basically, you know, providing or preventing, I should say, funding to school districts that, you know, introduce mask mandates. And I think, you know, that shows, again, sort of a larger theme with the governor, which is that he has made decisions in the COVID arena that have been primarily based on politics and not on public health, because we have public health advocates, educators, school administrators are saying that mask mandates will help mitigate the spread, a spread that we're seeing increasing across the state, you know, with our children. And yet the governor is making it hard for them to implement those kinds of mitigation procedures. And one can, again, only conclude that he is doing that for political reasons. And so that's disturbing. And again, it's been something that we've seen repeatedly from the governor.
Jaime.
Well, the governor's trying to, well, the governor does not want, and he's not going to institute mandates on masks or vaccines. We know that. So this is kind of the easy way of saying, look, we're not going to mandate this, but we're going to fund the antibody treatments that could help mitigate when people get this new Delta variant and are in the hospital. I think Roy's right. The hospitals aren't complaining because they need the staff. I mean, bottom line is, I mean, the hospitals are stretched thin right now, extremely thin, and a lot of it is not just the bed space, but having the personnel there able to treat these folks. I'm told that a massive amount of this funding will go just for nurses. And so that they have people that can treat these folks that are in the hospital. But this, again, allows the governor to say, okay, look, we're going to release these dollars, but we're going to use it for specific things. We're still not going to do mandates, but we're going to, while you're there, we're going to offer to get your vaccines once you are released. So they're continuing to push the vaccines, which I think is a good thing, but they're trying to balance that not mandating versus how do we treat this spread.
Jaime, one of the things that the governor talked about this week was the idea of really pushing vaccines. He's been talking about that for a long time, to his credit. He's been really encouraging people to get vaccines. But as we know, there's a certain population that is not eligible for vaccines, especially people who are younger than 12 years old. And we're starting to see more and more kids in that age group contracting COVID. We're starting to see more and more of them ending up in the hospital. At some point, is the governor going to have to actually address that and not just say everyone should get their vaccine, everyone should get their vaccine? Because that clearly is not the solution for that population.
Yeah, but Mark, I think there's also this people don't want to have those mandates imposed upon them. I think if we were to do polling on this, I think people would say, look, you know, I believe there's ways to deal with this. I want to have my own freedoms as to how I'm able to function on a daily basis and how I'm able to, you know, have my children go to school or have my go into restaurants. I mean, that's my own personal decision. So the governor, in a way, is trying to balance that with, okay, how do I not impose mandates on people that don't want mandates, but at the same time, try and deal with this very real pandemic? So that's where I think, continuing to push for vaccinations, continuing to provide the resources that we can to deal with this is the right way to go.
Roy, what do you make of that? I mean, do you think at some point the governor, obviously it's to his credit, especially on the Republican side, that he is really pushing vaccines as much as he is. But, as I mentioned, there is that population of people who can't get them yet.
No, that's exactly right. And, I wish in a normal world, the governor would look at, the policies he's undertaking, what he's encouraging, and say, okay, well, this isn't working, and then reverse that in order to address the problem. I don't see that, mostly primarily because of political reasons. But the reality is children can't get vaccines. They're not allowed to do that at this point. And we're seeing an increase, spread of the virus in schools. I mean, I know plenty of educators that are screaming to the rooftops of the emergency that they are experiencing in their particular schools when you have classrooms that, are entirely quarantined and teachers and children getting the virus and getting very sick. And so because the vaccine is not available, masks are really the only way to do it. And again, we're in a situation to help stop the spread. And the only way to do that, or one of the ways to do that is to require masks in schools, yet we have a governor who is not allowing schools, not allowing the professionals to make their own decisions on what's best for their school districts. So I would hope that the governor sees this and changes course. I do appreciate his encouragement of vaccines, but it's just not enough, especially in schools.
Well, guys, that brings up the fact that end of last week, Mark talked with the new head of DHS, Don Harrington. Earlier this week, we talked with former Surgeon General Richard Carmona, who's getting involved in part to sort of push vaccinations at this point. And how many people are wondering, because one of the criticisms of Dr. Crist, even if she did a fine job, is that she was at least not publicly willing to disagree with the governor. Because it's a gubernatorial appointee, is that hard, or should we expect more from people running health departments?
Well, but let's flip that question a little bit. What if Governor Ducey were to impose mandates and were to impose mask requirements at every level and impose you have to get vaccinations if you're going to go into schools? other states that have gone down that path, have been much more aggressive than Arizona, continue to have as bad of a situation in their hospitals and as much of a COVID outbreak as we have in our state. So I guess that's what I'm saying. There's a balance from how do you continue to function as a society? How do you continue to function our economy in a way that is getting kids in school, for one thing? Remember, last year, schools didn't want to open. They were saying, no, sorry, I'm sorry, you know, I don't... kids may not be learning for an entire year, but we're going to go ahead and do this because our teacher organizations don't want to have that happen. I think the governor's trying to provide a balance. I think the new director of the health department, Dr. Carmona, how do you provide a balance to deal with this pandemic, but at the same time continue to function as a society, continue to have people make a living? I mean, that's where there's a bottom line to this, and there has to be a balance.
Jaime, how long do you think we're going to have to work on that balance? I mean, do you think there's a certain amount of fine-tuning that has to happen to get it just so?
Well, last year I thought it was, well, maybe in 6 weeks this will all be over. And now we are 16 months later. We're still dealing with it. You know, this is something we're all new at this. Even the experts are new at this. This is a pandemic that none of us have seen. So I think there's going to be an evolution as to how we deal with this. I am hopeful, based on the science and based on what we've been able to do, getting people to understand that these vaccinations are, in large measure, the key to dealing with this. That's where we're going to ultimately be able to control this, and over time be able to go back to a normalcy. But unfortunately, right now you just have these folks that just don't believe in science. And we just have to continue to educate. We have to continue to push it. To the governor's credit, he continues to pound that fact. But that's where we're going to have to figure out how do we balance this outbreak with, you know, people that don't want to do anything. But at the same time, we have to function as a society.
Roy, our last few minutes, let's move to some specific election-related items. I'm going to start, because you're a resident Democrat on this panel, I'm going to start with the Democrats and what's going on in Southern Arizona. Dr. Randy Freese decided to drop out of the chance to succeed Representative Ann Kirkpatrick. How do you think that changes the dynamic of the race down there?
Well, it's an interesting question. And in the interest of full disclosure, I was representing Dr. Freese in that campaign. So it was a surprise to me as well. But, you know, I think it was a surprise. I largely viewed him as as the front runner in that primary, although, you know, it's way early. But now we have two candidates left, and Daniel Hernandez is state legislator, and Kirsten Engel is also state legislator. I think there's a question, I suppose, if another candidate decides to jump in and sees an opportunity, but I highly doubt that happens. And so it'll be between the both of them. I think they're both great Democrats and would be great congresspeople. And then, of course, you've got a Republican primary developing down there with, you know, Juan Ciscomani, and, you know, who's a Ducey person, and some others. So I think it's going to be a fascinating race. Again, I don't want to get into the specifics of this, but, you know, one of the things that people will be watching is what that district looks like after redistricting, just like all the other districts. And so, you know, we'll see sort of what that looks like and how that affects the race. But it definitely was a surprising development, both personally and I think from the political world.
Yeah, Jaime, that district is usually considered one of the more competitive ones, not just in Arizona, but around the country. And to Roy's point, we don't know exactly what it's going to look like once the redistricting process is finished. Do you get the sense that Representative Freese dropping out greatly shakes up that race, at least on the Democratic side?
Well, I think it greatly helps Daniel Hernandez in that race. A lot of folks are speculating as to whether or not Gabby Giffords will actually come in and actually endorse him now, because he, from what I understand, would be a very strong candidate as a former staffer. Of course, you know, he lived through the tragedy that when she was shot. And if that were to happen, you know, Daniel will be a formidable candidate. And you're going to have two very strong Latinos running for a congressional seat. And you have Juan Ciscomani on the Republican side. And if you have Daniel Hernandez, that'll be an interesting dynamic. I would love to see that. I mean, finally, you have folks that are running for office, and it doesn't matter, you know, what their race is. But, you know, having two Latinos in that position, I think it just shows how the state has evolved and how that's a good thing for us.
Yeah. Our last 90 seconds or so. I mean, let me ask you about this attack ad. U.S. Senate candidate Blake Masters' PAC attacks the Attorney General Mark Brnovich. I guess we could have brought this up when we're talking about the audit, related to him not doing enough, apparently related to voter fraud. Is Mark Brnovich going to end up looking like the moderate in this race?
Well, Blake Masters is going to try to make him look like a moderate. I think this is one of many attack ads that we're going to be seeing. It's funny, you know, we're only in September of 21, and, you know, so we're going to see a lot of money being put into this race for the primaries and then ultimately for the general. But no, your question, I don't think Mark Brnovich is going to be portrayed as a moderate. They're going to try to, and with Republican primary voters, it'll be the degree of how much they feel who's the most conservative, and that's where they're trying to position themselves.
And Roy, I think to the some of the points you and Jaime were making earlier about the political impact of this audit, how do you see an ad like this? Is this sort of a harbinger of what we can expect for the next year or so?
Well, I think so. I mean, I'll start by saying that Mark Brnovich is not a moderate, so they may try to do that, but that the reality and facts, I think, speak for themselves. But I do think, you know, this idea, and we've talked about this in the context of Ducey and Brnovich, where Trump, you know, has expressed some hostility towards them because he hasn't felt like they've pushed enough in this idea of there being election fraud, which, of course, as we discussed, never happened. And so it'd be curious to see, you know, whether that affects the primary going forward, if Trump or people that are, you know, associated with Trump end up, you know, helping Brnovich's opponents in the primary, you know, because of that. And so that'll be very interesting to see. But, you know, from a Democratic perspective, this is kind of what I expected, you know, from some of the, you know, perhaps more not moderate, but perhaps more non-Trumpian Republicans in a primary going against Trumpian Republicans. You know, you're going to see that kind of, you know, race to the bottom to try to demonstrate allegiance to Trump because he is such a looming presence in a Republican primary.
All right, we'll stop there. Attorney, former congressional staffer Roy Herrera, thank you as always.
Thank you so much.
And Jaime Molero of Molero Alvarez. Jaime, take care.
Thank you very much, Steve. Thank you, Mark.
You've been listening to the Friday Newscap from KJZZ's The Show. It's an original podcast recapping the week's big stories with experts, commentators, and reporters. You can get the full show podcast at podcast.kjzz.org. If you have any questions or comments, please email us at theshow@kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein, and thanks for listening.